Well, this project is part of a much broader one, which is on urban justice in urban contexts. And it'll be a long one. It was announced at a conference, actually, of the Urban Affairs Association meetings, which some of us, Patrick and Lorne and Daniel, were at a couple of years ago. And one of those contexts is citizenship. So it's really a talk more about citizenship for those who've read the paper than it is about justice. But it's the ultimate aim, and if my synapses last, I hope to actually complete this project. It will still have something to do with justice, and I'll flag places where I'm looking for some help. Now, because it's embedded philosophy, I'm greatly influenced by John Dewey. So I'm thinking out of a Deweyan perspective. Also by probably the most spectacular exercise of very finely yet profoundly embedded urban philosophy, namely Walter Benjamin's study of the Paris arcades, out of which it was astonishing just how much he could draw in the way of these things. But I'm not going to be speaking primarily about either Dewey or Benjamin. I'll have something to say about the latter. More Aristotle. Now, I don't have actually an image of Aristotle, but over lunch I decided I would put this one up, his most famous student. This is thanks to Luke's presentation. This is taken in Heliopolis about 2 days into the democratic revolts in Egypt. And these are some of the revolters, the Democrats, standing on a statue of Alexander the Great. I thought that was Aristotle mainly who I'm going to be talking about. Isn't that a terrific photo? I'm very proud of that one. So I went back to the politics and was it was amazing how much I was able, just a minute, I don't want to send an error report, do I? Unless it's a philosophical error. Wait a minute. Don't send. Okay. There is Aristotle's, I'm going to race through this because there's a lot. That's what Aristotle had to say about citizenship. Et c'est là exactement la même chose en français. So this is the concept of that I'm going through, and it's a robust concept of citizenship. So what is robust citizenship? Well, first of all, it's of broad scope. Here, Aristotle actually does fall down in two respects, namely slaves and women. No small failing in either case. However, aside from that, and that's a huge one, but broad scope means, how come 16-year-olds can't vote? Why not immigrants, recent immigrants? Why should anybody who's going to be affected by a decision not be able to vote, for example? However, robust citizenship also involves voting beyond, participating beyond voting, so a more participatory, deliberative approach to thing. Also, it can involve even insurgency. Who was it this morning from the mic who referred to insurgency? Insurgent citizenship means challenging civil disobedience citizenship, even in the extreme. So I'll digress for just a second show you a few slides from a terrific display at the Canadian Center for Architecture, which is within walking distance of this hotel. And if you can possibly find time to go there, absolutely do it. It's one of the most magnificent museums of anything that I know. And certainly, do you agree, Daniel? Isn't it a terrific place? It's worth to go to. Yes, okay. So this is called Action. And so what can you do with a city? And it was things that you can do with a city. These all involve insurgent citizenship. So here we have a soccer field that citizens on their own, this wasn't done by any city administration, none of these things were, some were opposed, turned it into a soccer field. Or here we have in San Francisco a parking space converted to a parquette. Or again, very common, we have quite a few of these now in Toronto, these are tomatoes colonizing a traffic island, so you have that sort of thing. This is one in Sao Paulo, which also has a lot of insurgent citizenship going on, tons of it. If you get into the favela, it's all insurgency. But even in outside of it, there was an urban expressway that was appropriated. That happened in New York, and then later it got adopted by the city, and so you have that wonderful walkway. Here we have an instant pedestrian crossing in Germany. People roll it up and bring it in. I rather like this one. They started making benches that people couldn't sleep on in my city recently. Well, here's a device with these foam things you bring along, and you can defeat the purpose of that purpose. Here we have a dumpster that in Seville, some kids, neighborhood kids, turned into a teeter-totter. Here we have a man who converted himself into a car, or a walkmobile in Vienna. Those are examples of insurgent citizenship. Virtuous urban character. I'm supposed to be able to see where I'm going here. I want this to depress. How do I do that? So
keep clicking here.
Here?
Yeah. If you click there, it'll keep going down.
Okay. This is just so I don't forget what I'm supposed to be saying. I might forget even with these things. Who knows? So virtuous urban character. This is a side of Aristotelian thinking. Here we get a little bit more philosophical that I really think is extraordinarily useful for urban philosophy, and that is that it doesn't, in the way of, say, T.H. Marshall, who's famously written about citizenship as essentially and indeed exclusively a matter of rights. It's not a rights-based approach. It's not incompatible with them, and I'll talk a little bit about rights later, but it's virtue. It's a virtue ethic, which one would be looking at. And maybe we can talk more about the virtues later. All right, start right now. So what I'm meaning by robust citizenship. This is a quote from the study that Benjamin wrote for the Arcades project, the project about Les Passages de Paris. He wrote it before he did the projects and sent a copy to Horkheimer and Adorno saying, I'm thinking of writing a book on this. And they wrote back saying, Walter, this is a really dumb idea. It's a bad idea. It won't work. Forget it. Do some serious philosophizing. If you want to talk about cities, well, fine. Emboldened by this advice, he wrote an 800-page book. And the closing phrase in that is, so he's talking about the Dioscuri. The Dioscuri, here it is also in French. The Dioscuri, of course, that's Castor and Pollux. Those are the twin sons of Leda. One of them fathered by Zeus and the other by a mortal. And of course, Leda was mortal. So that makes the ensemble, the Dioscuri taken together, three quarters human and one quarter divine. This, in tandem with other things Benjamin has to say in the Arcades project, strikes me as about the balance he had in mind. So the standard contrast in city thinking during this epoch especially, but even today, is between Babylon and Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is it's a holy city, it's ordered, it's moral, all those things, whereas Babylon is secular, it's disordered, chaos, immorality, and so on. Avner can tell us whether this is an accurate representation of his hometown. Then there's the question that we confronted a little bit, talked a little bit about this morning, on the utopian versus the non-utopian points of view. Le Corbusier and the people in that tradition, and Jane Jacobs and hers. Jacobs likes to see a certain amount of chaos. Things evolve in no ordered way out of neighborhoods and so on, whereas for the people in the utopian tradition, where Le Corbusier must certainly be located, it's his, the phalanstery was the model for it, are looking at things being being much more ordered. So Aristotle picks this notion up as well as Benjamin. Benjamin was reacting, as was George Simmel, reacting against the notion of cities being unified, ordered, platonic, utopian. And Benjamin, like Simmel, was arguing against that. So was Aristotle. Quite an astonishing quotation from the Politics. here it is also in English. The unity of a city is not its greatest good, it's the ruin of the polis. My opinion is that for Aristotle, but certainly for Benjamin, cities, if you ask the question, are they to be thought of essentially as coherent or incoherent, both normatively and descriptively, the answer is both. They are coherent and they are incoherent. So insofar as they are coherent, they exhibit the traits on the left-hand side of the screen, and insofar as they are incoherent, the ones on the right-hand side of the screen. So this suggests a way of thinking about the civic virtues, so picking up again on the Aristotelian notion of virtue. And I used to think there were two of them, toleration and concern, where concern is sort of paired with coherence. It's supposed to, mutual concern is supposed to help to make a city cohere. And I think it should be commitment to equal well-being. Now, everyone here will understand that both the terms equal and well-being are problematic terms. So how to flush them out is very important for this project, and I will welcome any advice. Now, it's not just flushing them out in terms at the level of political philosophy or ethics. It's also at the level of popular culture or morality. This embedded approach will always move, as does the thinking of Benjamin, as does the thinking of Aristotle, as does the thinking of Dewey, at the overlap, at that gray area between ethics and morality, between rigorous political philosophy and social, political, cultural politics and thinking. I think you have to add a third to that, and this I was persuaded of by environmentalists in my department, in my university. Department two, Ingrid Stefanovich, who teach environmental urban philosophy. So I think that trusteeship needs to be added to that mix. And there's the same thing in French. So then, a bulk of this paper, but I'm only going to race through it, has to do with preconditions for the nurturing of these civic virtues. What is required to do that? And most, but not all of these, I get are in Aristotle. If you start with his list, you've got about two-thirds of the list, an appropriate list, and there's pros and cons. Aristotle was a big proponent of public education for non-slave boys, mind you, but nonetheless, within that constraint, and admittedly a huge one, but still within that, he wanted not just public education, but he wanted a common curriculum for all classes. Public spaces. And we've talked about that already this morning, a precondition. Urban design, yet another important one. Now, look, there's limits to how far urban design can take you. It happens that the man who designed the existing square in front of City Hall in Jerusalem is a Torontonian, is a Toronto architect. And when he was doing this, he bragged to me that his design for the City Hall Square in Jerusalem would bring peace to the Middle East. So this is, as it were, the pretense of some of these folk. But here's what I mean. Here's the utopian. Here's Christianopolis, which was Thomas Campanella's utopian thing. And look at the similarity of that to who has to be the most profound and subtle of the utopians, Fourier, Charles Fourier. What they are marked by is walls. They both stand in contrast to Athens. This is what Athens looked like at the time of Aristotle. Now it did have a wall around it, but that wall was for a really good purpose, namely to keep the Spartans from coming and raising the city or anyone else. These walls were not. The walls of the utopians, because these were imaginary edifices. These were imaginary times and places where there wasn't war and all the rest of it. They were symbolic, and they had to do with the rigorous categorization of how people live and what they do, etc. So if you abandon that, what you get, I think, is more what we were talking about this morning. Somebody mentioned Sennett, Richard Sennett. And I think Sennett talked about the importance of soft boundaries as opposed to rigid walls. That kind. So urban design can play a role if it's done rightly. Size, Aristotle, interestingly, it was to be, you know, big enough that you could have a appropriate division of labor, small enough that you could communicate. He didn't assign a number, a population number to this. And I think that that's right, because with modern technology, communications technology, you can have a much bigger city. Aristotle thought that the glue, the most important glue for holding together a city and for promoting the civic virtues was friendship. My view, which I will defend if needs be in discussion, is that that's too strong, especially in big modern cities. Though I do think, and you can study this phenomenologically better than any other way, something like friendly comportment is conducive to these things. Well, if friendship is too strong a condition, I think self-interest, although it certainly can play a role, and there is something to the Thibautian and approach, and even to the neoliberal approach to cities, nonetheless, I think it's too weak. I just don't think that the prisoner's dilemma, I think the prisoner's dilemma besets cities more obviously and damagingly than maybe any other locales, so I'm not sure about that. Some people think that, taking up on Marshall's view, that liberal rights is the way to go. I'm not so sure about that, but I do think that something analogous to liberal rights and individualism does play a role. So Zimmel distinguishes between two competing forces from the time of the Enlightenment. Universalism and particularism. Both of them overlap in that they are pro-individual, and he thinks that it's in cities in particular that the constant negotiation between universalist individualism and particularist individualism takes place, to the extent the argument would go that this is done in a productive, not a mutually destructive way, but ways that would work away at having it both ways, to that extent are civic virtues. So the argument would go, to that extent are the civic virtues nurtured. Now, are these necessary conditions? Well, one presupposition of this approach is that, as a presumption anyway, and I think it's only a presumption, I know I've lost this, no, I haven't. They don't look at these conditions, friendship and education and so on, as necessary conditions so much as ignis conditions, thus defined. I don't know if this exists in French philosophical literature, it's theory of causation, but it would be minus conditions, sort of the same thing. Returning to the list, civic pride, very important. However, there's civic pride and then there's civic pride. And a lot of these monumental things that are built, like the ones that Luke was talking about this morning, I think is civic pride in the wrong direction. Or the Olympics village and so on in Vancouver, already beginning to unravel in terms of how proud it makes people of its city as it becomes a basis for gentrification. Beginning to unravel. On the other hand, our mayor, previous mayor, Mayor Miller, I think did a really good thing in turning Toronto into some place that was trying to develop, become an environmental city, and to the extent that he succeeds, that would give us pride. Civic memory. Richard Dogger, who was spoken of earlier, is a person who promotes the importance of civic memory. Here's an example of it. The Spadina Expressway was an effort that was stopped by a massive citizen movement in the 70s, early 70s, and certainly prevented Toronto from turning into Detroit, almost certainly. Or there was the interurban railway system. That was a system that existed until shortly after the Second World War, when it was dismantled under pressure from the auto manufacturers. These were electric trains. They ran as trains between cities and as streetcars within them. So what people say, oh, if only we had something like that today, we had it. We had it in 1905, 1908, 1910. It covered the whole Northeast quadrant. You could go to New York. My parents used to be able to go to New York or Chicago, Montreal, up to the lakes and so on these trains. Here's another one. That's part of it in Montreal. I believe that to be Rue Saint-Jacques, but it didn't say. Maybe somebody can recognize the Commercial Union Building and tell me if that's where that was. I would like to know. Is it? That's Rue Saint-Jacques in St. Jamestown. Yeah, right. So civic memory, very important. Finally, and lastly, class. Notice that some of the, you can sort these conditions into those that are structural, like size, and ones that involve that are not structural but involve, you know, effort, civic memory, and civic pride. Finally, class. Aristotle thought that conducive to the nurturing of civic virtues in his in his types of cities was a large middle class, because the poor were downtrodden and be jealous, and the rich were too greedy, and the middle class was neither. Well, I'm a member of the middle class, and alas, I see downtroddenness and jealousy and greed all too evident in that class. But you can generalize it in economic terms, I think, and then add another, as it were, methodological presupposition, the first one being that these conditions are ignis conditions, not necessary conditions, not sufficient conditions alone. I'm virtually done. But all of the conditions, like justice itself in a city, like virtue in the city, are matters of degree. And therefore, you can talk about progress in robust citizenship. And here, and this is where I think I come closest to engaging theories of justice, here, the what's behind Aristotle's classification, namely a middle class, meaning people that don't have so much that they kind of see themselves in an elitist way as separate from the rest of the population, and have no stake in things like, we would say, healthcare for him, public education, and those who have so little that they just can't participate in public life, in robust, that something in between that is needed, and the more the better, and that has led me to abandon an earlier anti-utopian view that I once embraced. I think that cities are coherent and incoherent. The coherent side invites some utopian thinking, but it seems to me that utopian thinking, which would be the limit, it would be full virtue, full justice, full realization of these conditions, would be a target to aim at, even if you could never succeed. And so I guess I have to agree with Henri Lefebvre. Now, finally, we may ask the question, how are urban virtues to be instilled and by whom? Unfortunately, I'm out of time, and so I have answers to those questions, of course, but, well, there's no time to express them. So there's my talk.
Since you invited the question, I'll ask you about friendship. What you said seems very plausible in terms of citizens in general, but I wonder if you think that you presume there's going to be a minority of the population that's seriously civically active any given time. There's going to be leaders who emerge. Wouldn't you think that friendship would be a good idea among that class of people, particularly in diverse settings? I mean, I would find some comfort if I knew that the mayor or someone connected to the mayor had actual friendship with all the different diverse constituencies. So maybe not friendship as a generalized virtue, but at least as an elite virtue, if you will, seems to have some plausibility. That's one question. Second question is that the insurgency piece seems to have dropped out when you came back to Aristotle. So when you came back into the Aristotelian frame, that the insurgency stuff that you talked about at the beginning seemed to drop out of the picture. So I'm wondering, is the insurgency what you get in a messed up, non-ideal city, or is there a way that can be even in the more just ideal city, there still be a space for insurgent citizenship?
Well, is this working?
Yeah.
You can have degrees of insurgency, and the higher the degree of insurgency, depending upon how it's done, I don't mean by that from organized public disobedience and movements to riots and anarchism, which I think is self-defeating. But if the right kind of insurgency increases to a certain level, I think that helps. That will make great progress toward, because it kind of shakes up all these other conditions and can lead toward a more just city and a more virtuous city. Would it auto-destruct at that point? I don't know. That's for the post-utopian society to think about. It's like, when Ingalls was in one of his books, Orders of the Family, Private Property in the State, I think, Ingalls, people said, well, what will happen if you ever have equality between the sexes? What will it be like? And Ingalls says, well, that'll be for them to decide. It's going to be monogamy, specifically with respect to monogamy and non-monogamy. So I don't, you know, I can't tell you. There still could be room for insurgency. One would hope it's a softer insurgency. On friendship, no, I don't agree that it would be a good thing if the leaders were friends. It might be a good thing, but it wouldn't necessarily be a good thing, and it could even be a bad thing because it could lead to cliques. And in fact, right now, what it sometimes leads to is special favoritism and things like that. Or even if it doesn't lead to that, it's perceived to be. What I do think needs to, a city does require, amongst not just the leaders, but everybody else, but certainly amongst the leaders, is what I call friendly comportment. And that is, in my city right now, that is sorely lacking. If you attend a city council meeting, what you're going to see is pitched warfare and name-calling and abuse and so on, much of it led by the mayor and our new horrible mayor. And so is there any Torontonian who disagrees with me here in that appellation? I doubt it. Friendly comportment is something quite different than that. Friendly comportment, and that's why I say it's the kind of thing that phenomenologists might want to study, friendly comportment has to do with just basic street-level civility. And that's sorely lacking in lots of cities. I think that that's the kind of thing you need amongst both leaders and followers. The example I give in the paper is a queue of people at the supermarket. And some queue crasher comes and smashes into the line in the front. Well, people are outraged at this, and I don't think the only reason that they're outraged, or should I put it this way, if the only reason they were outraged is that therefore the queue is advanced by one, and so they have longer to wait to get to the cash register, if that's all it was, then it wouldn't involve friendly comportment. Friendly comportment means an understanding that a wrong has been done to everybody in the queue, and even more so if the queue crasher has kind of hurt somebody, and it's that sort of thing. So very mundane. But the more of it there is, it seems to me, both amongst leaders and amongst non-leaders, the better it is for the nurturing of civic virtues.
I have two questions. The first one concerns size. I wonder why you see it as an important condition, especially since you mentioned that with technology, it could mean basically anything. So I wonder what you have in mind with this condition. And the other question is, so I look at all these conditions for civic virtues, and I wonder what it means in an urban perspective. And it seems to me that the best type of community I know that would foster those conditions, not ideally, but looking at them as a group, would be a gated community. The gated communities down the south are seems to be very good on many of those points, and so I'm sure you don't want to defend them. So I was wondering how starting with an Aristotelian framework you could reject gated communities.
The first question is, I just glossed over it, I guess. I'm saying that size is one of Aristotle's criteria, but the fact that he doesn't give a number is significant, because that throws you back not on the actual size, but on why it is that size matters. And why it matters is that you need to have both room for plurality and division of labor and all the rest of it on the one hand, but you also has to be big, but it also has to be such that people are able to have, not to be lost in the crowd, to have some way of if they wish to be interacting and participating, etc. So those are the conditions. I think that civic virtue, I've lived in Japan a couple of times, three times, and one of those times in Tokyo, and I had the distinct impression that Tokyo, a town ten times the size of Toronto, 30 million instead of 3 million, has a more virtuous citizenry than Toronto. So it isn't, it can't just be a matter of size. That's on that point. Now, as to the gated community question, First of all, I think it would be most, that's the solution, that is really a design solution. That's one that sees urban design as at the key to it, because the gated communities at their best, unless they're just fortresses, are in fact new urbanist enclaves. That's what they are at their best. So suppose you had one that's at its best, and I don't know what that would be. Would Seaside, Florida work? I'm not sure. It's their showcase, but it was also the set for the Truman Show, you know, so it's not... Yeah. At their best, yeah, some of those things might be nurtured. But this comes back, I think, largely to what you were talking about. Oh, empirically, now I did have a student who was a sociology student working on just this question. And what she was, her hypothesis, and at the and so, some of her, depending on her major, some of which were kind of hard to figure out, but she seemed to be showing that these sorts of virtues are not existent in the gated communities. That the gated communities foster a fortress mentality, a mentality of mutual suspicion and fear, which you can't turn off at the gate. And so, so they don't do that. But your point about exit and mobility and all the rest of it certainly comes into play here.
I just was wondering if you could clarify the relationship between civic virtues or citizenship and the conditions for it, because I wasn't sure if it was a sort of a matter of logical deduction that these conditions were things that we could deduce from the concept of civic virtue, or if instead they were related empirically, in which case it might turn out that some of them don't promote civic virtue. And thinking of Clarissa's paper, I was going to ask you about public space in particular. As much as I find this counterintuitive, it is possible that we would find, and you know, Robert Putnam found something along these lines, that actually people have a more sense of trust and, let's say, even active civic virtue if they don't have public spaces. As long as they don't see the other people, they imagine they're just like themselves, they support helping them, they feel, you know, they deserve to have redistribution of the resources of the community or something like that. Their rights should be respected. When you actually see them and they're kind of dirty and they're a member of a different race, then actually you stop supporting those things. And so they're inversely correlated to what you could imagine as some empirical measure of civic virtue. In that case, would we sort of cross some of those off the list? And if not, why not?
The answer, yeah, we would cross them off the list. The exercise is entirely empirical. It's empirical hypothesis. That is, I am hypothesizing these things. Luckily, I'm a philosopher, so I don't have to actually prove them. It isn't entirely in a vacuum. Some of it is out of just, direct experience. And I have been active for 30 years in street-level and city-level urban politics in my city, so I could give a lot of anecdotal stories. And it's also borne out by some but not all of the empirical research. The problem is, of course, as you know, that the fact that it's said by an empirical researcher doesn't always make it so. And you know, you have to look at the methodologies and check things out. With Putnam, for example, I do know that point, but I've read several empirical critiques of Putnam on exactly this point. Nonetheless, yeah, these are hypotheses. And and if you're going to be doing embedded political philosophy or any other in political philosophy, it seems to me that you cannot avoid empirical speculation. Now, there's two ways to do it. One is to turn yourself into an incredible genius, somebody who knows everything. And there are very few who can do that. Ian Hacking in The Philosophy of Science comes close with respect to science, but he's unlike most of my colleagues who get hired and tenured on the pretense that they're geniuses, aren't. But he is. So he can do that. Very few people can, and especially with something as complex as cities. So the other way to do it is to invite people who do have the people who agree with you that these virtues are paramount and central and important for cities. People who agree with you on that, but have the empirical expertise and knowledge and resources at their disposal to test the hypotheses, do so. I work in the City Center at the University of Toronto, future home of Lauren King, actually, and pro tem anyway, unless we can get you to defect. I'm the only, not only philosopher, the only, you know, humanist there. The rest are all geographers and planners and some architects and engineers and so on. And And they do pursue work along these lines, and in discussion with him, I find it these hypotheses so far borne out. But yeah, it's empirical.
Following up on the last two questions, I was wondering why, if we think about like a gated community or some other kind of an enclave, and thinking about the previous panel, which sort of emphasized the externalities that are created within one community across the boundaries of the community, why is it not the case that tolerance of and some kind of concern for the others with whom I stand in relations of power across the borders of my enclave is part of what civic virtue requires? So in other words, don't we need to sort of problematize, like, what's the relevant community in these kinds of cases?
Well, I think here's where I really rest. I share, I'm informed by Benjamin and by Georges Simmel and by others, who are, first of all, taking account of the fact that cities just aren't like gated communities. Gated communities are a tiny, tiny portion of the urban population, and often they're not even urban. As a matter of fact, people live and want to live in big, complex cities. So those are the things that you need. You can. It then does become kind of utopian. This was the idea of. This is one of the reasons Jane Jacobs didn't like Howard, Ebenezer Howard, because who really is the forerunner of the Garden City, which is again realized in these gated communities. It could at best serve a small proportion of the population, and more importantly than that, you lose something in these small communities, in these controlled communities. You lose the kind of you lose the incoherence of cities, or even the chaos of cities. And chaos is, and Aristotle seems to agree with this, is part of the lifeblood of. If you think that chaos is part of the lifeblood of a city, that it's that which allows people to interact with complete strangers and people from a whole bunch of different backgrounds with different worldviews and so on, either well or poorly. And if well, then it's mutually enriching and so on. If you think that, then you're going to want to come up with civic virtues and ways of nurturing them which are appropriate to these metropolises. So that's the reason. Would it be better if we could just pare down the human population, somehow educate people to want to live only in gated communities? I don't think so. I'd find it boring. I escaped a small community at the earliest possible opportunity myself. But it's beside the point. It's just not on the cards.
Just staying on this theme, and I think a sort of compliment to Clarissa's question. I mean, I don't think I disagree that our hypotheses about urban citizenship and the virtues thereof have to respond to the way the world is and make some sort of hypothesis. But it does seem another way to answer Peggy's question is simply to say, I don't care if people are tolerant. That's the virtue of citizenship. And virtues are hard to live up to. And I guess, why not just take that stance? Right.
Go by it again?
Why make these virtues tied to the empirics of cities? Why not just say this is the virtue of urban citizenship? And it's hard, and it's tough, and sometimes you're in there messing it up with people you don't much like, and you're kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah. Here's the reason. And it has to do with at least how I conceive of embedded urban or any other philosophy, and it's Deweyan. And that is... And this opens a can of worms. I began by this. Well, cities are both coherent and incoherent, and so these suggest these virtues, right? And then I talk about the conditions, as if there's the city and its virtues, and then there's the conditions. Well, it is, to use the term that started being used this morning, reflective. The nurturing, how different conditions are nurtured and which ones, because remember we're talking largely about ineous conditions and not necessary and sufficient conditions, what packages you have and what are realistic and what work and don't work in a particular city and how they are done and all the rest of it, almost certainly are going to begin to have an influence on not just whether people adopt the virtue of tolerance, but what tolerance is, how tolerance works. I mean, tolerance goes from one extreme of just live and let live to the other Charles Taylor-like extreme of mutual respect and learning and all the rest of it, and there's things in between. Both would be good things, exactly how it's thought of is going, how it gets realized, and even therefore how it ought to be realized on the principle that ought implies can, is going to vary depending upon condition to condition and how the conditions are nurtured. That's the reason that I don't take the easy philosophical route out and fob it all off to the social scientists.
So just a kind of institutional question. What do you have an idea of what the best institutional arrangement for inculcating these virtues are? And so sort of situated on a spectrum, there are some institutions that are self-generating, right? There could be those that are provided by the state or imposed by the state. And there are those who facilitate participation in state institutions. So you've mentioned several times that you're involved in city politics. In Edmonton, for example, they have planning schools for ordinary citizens, right? So that they can understand how the planning process works. So do you have it in your own mind? At the end of the paper, you talk about the Deweyan conception of how to build up from problems that spiral, right? The sort of virtue spiral. Do you have a picture of what institutions that help inculcate virtue look like for the city?
So I just had a quick question about the governing half of this. We have the virtue half, but the governing half. And my immediate reaction to the coherence-incoherence divide was that the incoherent city is ungovernable. Now, you don't draw that link, but I wonder if you have thoughts about that. That is, right, we have, at least in the 60s and 70s, the city was thought to be ungovernable in part because, and I don't think incoherence in your terms means the same thing, but it slides towards that. So I'm wondering just about the governing side.
Yeah. No, good question. Coherence doesn't pair with governability and incoherence with ungovernability in my parlance. It might be more like this. Really a key thinker in all this would be Jane Jacobs, Death and Life of American Cities. And her view was that that urban design and urban politics, including urban governance, should take its lead from what's happening at the most local level within a city, and in particular in its neighborhoods, much of which is not going to be in any formal institutional structure. That's where it should take its lead. But that doesn't mean that therefore there should be no governance. It means that the governance that there is should be sensitive to local initiatives, local activities, and all the rest of it. A concrete example, this meeting I was at representing our association about this condo proposal was organized by a terrific city councilor named Adam Vaughan. Some of you will remember his father was a TV personality, and before that a writer named Colin Vaughan, who was then a counselor. Colin Vaughan found himself always battling various villains, and the worst villain voted 4 years in a row the most worst slum landlord in the city. It was a guy named Wynn. Now he's deceased, but his sons, the Wynn brothers, are fighting his son, Adam Vaughan. So this was Adam Vaughan fighting the sons of the elder Vaughan. What Adam is very good at doing is before a development proposal goes to official channels, goes to a committee of adjustment to challenge by, they want exemption from the bylaws, or goes to a truly nefarious organization we have in Ontario called the Ontario Municipal Board, which is able to, what we didn't say to our American friends is that in Canada, since the founding of the country, cities are entirely wards of the provinces. They have very, very little power except property tax, and hence huge amount of city income depends on property tax in Canada, which skews everything. Anyway, before it goes to all of these boards, Vaughan will organize along with citizen groups meetings. And there'll be informal meetings. They might go on and off for a year or longer, and people will sort of try to come to some accord. And he even tries to do a kind of a Rawlsian veil of ignorance exercise, where he'll have some meetings where people from a local part of the city will, business and developers and ordinary citizens and so on, you know, residents, will try to come up with criteria they can all agree on. And then when the actual applications come forth, you have something to measure them against. Now, that to me is all part of governance. And if you have a formal governmental structure, it does involve an actual governor, namely the councillor, but if you have a formal governmental structure that respects this, that listens to it, and so on, then you'll be able to kind of have it both ways, to take advantage of the good side of incoherence and the good side of coherence. So that's a long-winded, but that's the answer to the question as I see it. Now, the other question, which I've completely forgotten, it was, sorry, I told you the synapses are, that's why I'll never finish this project. It was
institutions.
I wouldn't want to lay down any, I can tell you what I think would be appropriate institutions in my own city. And it would be a long and question to answer, and a hard one too. I don't see that these would be necessarily transposable to other cities. Cities might learn from one another, and they could. What you can do, though, it seems to me, is to lay down some touchstones or guidelines. And the touchstones or guidelines, these aren't all of them. There's lots of them that I favor are. Whatever form of institutionalization or institutional structures you have, they must be such as to be conducive to these conditions, that is, the conditions of civic virtue.
Thank you very much.